Well, are you tired of turkey leftovers yet? I never get tired of them personally, but some of you might. Thanksgiving is just past, and so I thought it would be a good time for us to talk about that most American of holidays and its remarkable significance in American constitutional history. Yeah, you heard me right. Thanksgiving is wrapped up in all sorts of our history and even to some extent in current debates. It has something to do with abolition. It has something to do with equality. It has something to do with economic organization. It has all kinds of things to do with the conflict between New England society and Southern society, a conflict which, quite frankly, continues to this day. I had no idea until my wife called me in the kitchen and said, "Stuart, you got to talk to this woman named Diana Muir Applebaum." Stay tuned.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
Thanksgiving is the most American of holidays, but I didn't realize just how American it is until recently I spoke with an author by the name of Diana Muir Applebaum, who's written, well, actually wrote 30 years ago, a fascinating book that I just recently learned about from my wife. It's called Thanksgiving, an American Holiday, an American History. I'm sure you can still get copies of it on Amazon or from somewhere on the internet. I'm sure it's still available. Fascinating read and a fascinating story. And I was so pleased when I called up Diana and after expressing some surprise that I wanted to talk about a 30-year-old book, she agreed and sat down with me for an hour and told me this really, really remarkable tale. It was such a great interview that it went a little bit too long for this show. And so I'm going to have to cut out a few of the preliminary. And I'll simply say that we're going to be joining Diana when I asked her to differentiate between the two societies, both of which emanated ultimately from Britain, but which settled two different parts of the American East Coast. Of course, the first of them was Jamestown in 1607, settled by a bunch of English gentlemen, versus the Massachusetts Bay Colony, you know, Plymouth Rock, all of that good stuff, up in Massachusetts, that was settled by some very different people. Here's Diana telling us about some of those differences.
They were simply entirely different. Instead of being a group of young men with no practical skills, they were a group of middle and lower middle class farmers. They were coming because they wanted to find a place where they could be English and at the same time be Calvinist, and that was not available to them in England in 1620, but they were also coming with the expectation that they would have to earn their own living as farmers. That's what many of them, some of them at least, had done in England, but even the ones who had been shopkeepers or small or craftsmen knew that that's what they were coming to do. And they came, you know, it's true they came with seeds and shovels and that sort of thing, but they mostly came with the expectation that it would be a struggle and that they would have to be farmers and work hard with their own hands.
So food and harvest were a big thing right from the very beginning.
Well, yes, because lots of the kinds of crops that you grow, some of them weren't even farmed, but even the ones who were knew how to grow the kind of crop mix that you get in England, in eastern England, which is a mixed farming of dairy cattle and pigs and grain crops, barley and wheat. The problem, of course, is if you bring a cow into a place like New England was, or all of the Eastern Seaboard was in 1630, and let something loose like a Guernsey cow, a wolf will come and eat it. And that's just a fact.
Yeah, it is.
So it wasn't,
that's a bummer.
It wasn't straightforward, and it wasn't simple, and there was a great deal of hunger. And of course, we all remember, because all of us were fourth graders, we all know that they would have starved had they not found caches of Indian corn and had an Indian who had, two things that happened to Squanto, because there really was a Squanto. One thing that had happened to him was, as a young man, he had been taken aboard one of the many European ships that was off the coast catching codfish and had learned English. And the other thing that had happened to him is that a European disease, possibly measles or possibly smallpox, had wiped out not only his family, but his village, his tribe, so that he was a fairly lonely figure in the world and possibly predisposed to be kind and friendly to these English people.
Now, that's very gratifying to know that the stuff I was taught in the second grade is not completely nonsense. So there really was a Squanto, and he really did speak English, and he really did help the pilgrims.
Yes, because if you, even if you find something like seed corn or like corn, well, I don't know, have you ever tried to plant potatoes or grow a kitchen garden? It's not that easy.
I have killed many plants in my day, so I know exactly what you mean in that regard. Fortunately, I've never had to depend upon them for food. You mentioned something else there, though, that's often overlooked, and it's extremely important in North American history, and that is that there was a very large indigenous population here that suffered a terrible biological holocaust when they were exposed to European diseases, and Squanto was a remnant of that civilization, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. It was as you say, with a couple of little amendments I'm going to make.
Oh, please do.
But it was not a civilization in quite the simple sense. It was a series of little civilizations, little groups of people, each of whom spoke their own languages and had their own customs, so that when your particular little group was wiped out, you couldn't necessarily expect that the group in the next valley would feel at all kindly towards you. You might have had a generations-long war going on with them. The rivalries were intense. There were the Indian tribes were just like European nations. They conquered one another. They enslaved one another. They massacred one another. So that, and they weren't, it was a large population in some sense, but not the kind of density that you get in agrarian societies, in organized, dense societies. This was a farming and hunting and gathering population, so the numbers were small, which is the difference between the United States, north of the Rio Grande, and Mexico, and Central America, Peru, places where there were, in fact, large civilizations and a dense population. And therefore, even though horrifyingly high percentages died when European diseases were introduced accidentally, just some sailor got off a ship who was carrying the germ, when that happened and those germs spread, the die-offs were unimaginably large. 50%, maybe even 95% of some of these populations died. And in North America, that meant that some parts of the countryside were left with virtually no people at all. The reason that one of the reasons that Jamestown had much more trouble than Plymouth was because Jamestown was settled on a coast where there was an Indian population that was flourishing, was doing fine, whereas the people who came to Jamestown had the advantage of the fact that John Smith had already sailed north from Jamestown along the coast and had reported back to London that the coast of Massachusetts was empty, that everyone had died. And that was why the pilgrims chose to come to Plymouth, because they knew that they would not have to defend themselves against possibly hostile neighbors.
Wow, yeah, I've heard stories or read accounts that sometimes that the people settling, Europeans going to Massachusetts, would find entire villages just seemingly abandoned.
Yes, and recently abandoned. If you can imagine settling on a coast, trying to explore a coast where you would find empty hearths, empty shelters, tattered by two or three seasons of winter storms, but nevertheless standing like ghost towns or ghost campsites, like something in a horror movie, really.
Yeah, really rather macabre. Okay, well, that's unpleasant, but that does set the scene. And so Squanto was a lucky survivor of this, who also happened to speak some English, and he helped out the pilgrims. And, of course, the first order of business was growing food, and he helped them with that.
Yes, he showed them how to plant corn, quite literally, and that was what saved the colony. As I said, I think barley is what they had in East Anglia, but they weren't able to grow some of those crops here, and instead they switched to growing corn. And that worked very well, and they were able to eat. And he probably also showed them a little bit about how to handle the local fish, or how to, for example, there are fish runs that come in New England. You can feed yourself for months by simply putting the right kind of net into a river, catching the alewives as they run upstream in the spring, and if you know how to set them in the sun and dry them, then you've got a lot of food. And it's probably even true that he showed them how to take some of that extra fish and put it into the cornhill to fertilize the corn.
Well, even that's true.
Even that is very probably true.
Because I remember those pictures from my third grade textbooks showing about the mounds of corn and planting the corn and putting the fish in there for fertilizer. So this is great. I'm going to have to go back and thank my second and third grade teachers. Well, how long was it then before the Pilgrims up in Massachusetts got to the point where they were settled enough and had a harvest enough so that they wanted to have a Thanksgiving holiday?
These people were seriously committed to God. I mean, they were coming to this country. And here again, we have one of the contrasts. It's not as though the people who settled Virginia weren't God-fearing, but that wasn't why they came here. They came here to make money. The people who came to New England, although they were also interested in making a good living, and no one is painting them all as being some kind of selfless Mother Teresa types or anything, but they came here to worship God. And they saw his hand in everything. So after the first starving winter, when half of them died because they didn't have adequate shelter or adequate food, the next year they had planted corn and some of the English crops they brought, and they had also harvested some of the wild foods, and they could see by fall that they had enough to make it through the winter, and God's hand was in that from their perspective, and they immediately held a day of thanks. They did not have any intention of founding an annual holiday. They held a day of thanks because they believed that when something happened that showed God's beneficence, you should express your gratitude in prayer.
And so this very literally was a service or a day of thanksgiving for the very first full harvest that came through that gave them confidence that they wouldn't starve during the ensuing winter.
And also an astute political maneuver, because the coast was empty. The place where they settled was empty. Lots of the coast was empty. But there were Indian villages that had survived not that far away. And so in addition to being a sincere, day of thanks, which they would have from time to time as the years went by, they also wanted to solidify a kind of relationship with the neighbors, with Massasoit and his followers, and they wanted to do this, and they did this by inviting them over, by showing them how well-established the village was, how strong the stockade was, and what a gun could do. They had a shooting demonstration, and that was intended to... Well, it was not a bad diplomatic maneuver. We're going to be friends. We're going to make peace. We're going to live side by side. And we have these machines that you don't have. And if you don't want to live side by side with us and try anything, we'll shoot you. This is real real politics in a very competitive world.
That's really interesting. I'm reminded of a visit to Colonial Williamsburg and to the governor's palace there. And when you walk into the main entryway there, they have these large displays of muskets with bayonets gleaming all over the walls and maybe on the ceiling. I forget exactly where, but it's very prominently displayed. And the tour guides there will tell you that it was only partly for decoration. It was to impress people who came in with the military might of the colony. And it sounds like the Pilgrims were already up to that particular political maneuver at this early stage.
Absolutely.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Diana Muir Applebaum, who 30 years ago wrote a book that I just recently learned of called Thanksgiving, An American Holiday, and American History. And the title tells it all. We're going all the way back to Squanto and the Pilgrims. And pretty soon, we're going to start talking about stuff you don't know.
With the Pilgrim Fathers, you may have heard rather a lot about our notion. Crossing the ocean on the good ship Mayflower. Though it's true, our journey turned into quite a commotion. People report that we sported these hats, but that's not true. I mean, would you? Anyway, the main thing to say, we began the USA, a little band of religion fans from the East Midlands. We all believe slowly that England was becoming less holy, so set off for Holland, because there we had friends.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Diana Muir Applebaum, who a few decades ago actually wrote a book called Thanksgiving, An American Holiday and American History. I recently discovered it, and I'm having a fascinating discussion with Diana. She's been telling me about the earliest origins of Thanksgiving, and soon we will segue into some of its religious significance and what happened to it as it started spreading out of New England. So you start the first holiday. What happens next? Is it immediately adopted there in the Plymouth Colony, or what? What happens to the holiday?
You almost none of us can quite understand just how central, not just religious ideas and religious ideas about God, but the conviction in that their particular religious ideas were the right ones and the only right ones. Were very important, and this is a generation that is reacting against the Catholic Church, and always at the forefront of their mind was Catholicism. They were literally escaping from it. Remember, the Pilgrims had spent time in Leiden and in other cities in Holland, in the Netherlands. And there was still a war of independence going on between the Netherlands and the Habsburgs, the Spanish Habsburgs, which was the Catholic power in Europe, which had been trying to conquer the Calvinists in the Netherlands for almost a century at this point. And that was the reality of their world. It's true there were Indians next door. They were thinking, however, about the Spaniards and the Catholics and the Pope. And among the many things that they differed with the Pope on and with all Catholics on was the question of what is the proper way to worship God in terms of days of the week, holidays, the rhythm of worship. And they were quite certain, absolutely certain, that one of the original errors of the Catholic Church had been to celebrate holidays that are not mentioned in the Bible. You won't find Christmas in the Bible as a holiday. You won't find Easter. You find the crucifixion, but not a holiday called Easter. You won't find any saint's day. And therefore, all of those things were abolished, simply wiped off the calendar. They didn't replace them with holidays except for the one holiday that they recognized from the Bible, which was the Sabbath day. So they stopped work every seventh day, and they believed, or their theologians had worked out the idea that for any special beneficence of God, you could call the people together and have a special day of worship. Also, if things went horribly wrong, so if there was a horrible disease, if there was a famine, then you could have a special day of worship, which was a day of fasting, repentance, and prayer. And that was it. Anything else was completely forbidden. They didn't have a day of Thanksgiving every year because they didn't see a harvest as being as being something miracle-like, a special providence, as they would call it. They, a good harvest, if it was especially good, if there had been a drought in the summer, then they might have one. But not every year at first. That was not part of the program, although there were days of thanks for other causes, occasionally, like at the end of King Philip's War, that sort of thing.
Well, that's just fascinating. So they invented the holiday, but then they refused to formalize it as a holiday because it was inconsistent with their religious beliefs.
They didn't invent the holiday. They instituted something which was an old and widespread tradition in Europe, which was the idea that the civil authority could call a day of prayer when one seemed appropriate. So there had been such days of prayer in the Dutch Republic. There had been such days of prayer called under Henry VIII and under Elizabeth. You may remember that Queen Elizabeth II called one when England won the Falklands War.
Mm-hmm.
And we have also had some of our early presidents and governors would do similar calls to a day of Thanksgiving. So that's what they were doing. They were following that tradition, which they believed was biblically approved. They had no intention of inventing any holidays whatsoever. So in the late 1600s, by then the second and even the third generation and the fourth generation is coming online, and these younger people weren't, they weren't as preoccupied by reacting against the Catholic Church anymore. But like all young people, they liked to have a good time. They wanted to have an occasional family gathering, a party, and they very much liked the idea of having a Thanksgiving every year. And so for a few years there, you go back and forth between the different colonies, and there were several at first, because there's Massachusetts Bay, Plymouth, the New Haven colony, the Connecticut colony, which is up by Hartford, and each one, and Rhode Island, but Rhode Island was its own special case on these things. But they would sometimes the governor or even one congregation would declare a Thanksgiving, sometimes not. There were theological arguments, and it only settles down late in the 1600s. The argument essentially is effectively settled by a compromise. Everyone agrees that theologically you cannot establish a holiday on the order of All Saints Day or Easter, something that is on the Catholic calendar every single year. You can't do that. That would be theologically wrong. But a harvest is something so special, and when God gives it to you, every single year the governor can declare that it's a special providence that the harvest should have come. And so every governor declares it every year on a one-year, one-shot basis.
That's remarkable. And so Thanksgiving, as we know it, was a bunch of young whippersnappers who liked a good time rebelling against their conservative, no-fun parents.
And football.
They like football. They like football, too.
Yeah, it's a kind of a funny holiday because unlike the Sabbath, when it would be a violation of the Sabbath to go kicking a ball around the village green, you could do that on Thanksgiving. You could have a football game. You could have a singing party where you weren't singing psalms, where you would sing non-religious songs. You could have any kind of party you wanted to. People could just have fun. And that was popular.
Very, very interesting. Now, you said football. I thought you were joking about modern football, but you mean they had a sport where they were kicking balls around.
Yeah, there are people who know more about the history of sports than I do. And there's something like somewhere between, I don't know, I guess there's an idea that rugby and football and maybe even soccer come out of it. Certainly rugby and football come out of some kind of ball games that was played on English village greens and American village greens already in the 1600s.
So our tradition of lying on a couch and watching the Detroit Lions lose to the Vikings actually goes all the way back to the 1600s.
Right, but of course not with rubber balls. Footballs are still made from pigskin. I think these things were made mostly from an animal's stomach or a bladder that they would blow up and then kick around. It was, it was real old-time stuff.
Great. So Thanksgiving was fun just about from the beginning. And now we're up to the late 1600s, and governors are calling this on a regular annualized basis. Is it recognizable to us? I mean, are we eating the sorts of foods then that we're eating today?
Yeah, we are, and for a fairly organic, logical reason. If you're having a really big holiday, you want to make it look like a feast, and so you want some special food to go on the table. And weirdly, to our modern sensibility, by that point, they had gotten rid of the wool. So you could have lots of cattle, and cattle are something, if you have lots of land, which obviously there was a whole continent, so you could run a lot of cattle, and beef was fairly cheap. But taking care of poultry is a little tricky, and you can only grow so many of them. So chicken was much more expensive than beef, that's what I'm trying to say.
That's interesting.
Absolutely. And that lasts in this country until about 100 years ago.
Wow. So I guess they solved that wolf problem then. They were able to protect their cattle after a while.
They could protect the cattle, and they hadn't yet figured out how to grow chicken in large sheds. That was a 20th century thing. So they, chickens were something, you had a small number of them, they were around your garden, you could have a few ducks, geese, turkeys, but nobody could grow huge numbers of these things. The technology wasn't there yet. But if you wanted, again, to have a holiday, you want to serve the most expensive meat. And that would be poultry. And you also want something that kind of looks great in the middle of the table. And so a roast turkey was really, the go-to bird because it was expensive. It was festive because it was expensive and because it was big and it does look good. But there were also a couple of other funny dishes they served, things that we wouldn't think of. And one of them was plum pudding, which... I think most of us associate with Dickens and the Christmas Carol,
yeah,
and sort of old-time English stuff, But it was more, Christmas was forbidden.
That's right, yeah, it wasn't on the calendar.
Yeah, they're immigrants. They have these memories from the old country, so they want to have that food that they had when they were kids. So they made a plum pudding, but they made it for the big holiday that was American, which was Thanksgiving.
Very interesting. So it's even recognizable as of the late 1600s, but it's still very much a New England holiday at that point. When did it start to spread beyond New England?
Well, the thing about New England that's a little odd, but is true, is that you remember Malthus when he was talking about overpopulation? So when Malthus, he wanted to have a number that he could actually give a real-world example of just how fast a human population could breed. And the most impressive population in the world at that point for breeding, like rabbits, if you will, was the population of New England.
Wait a minute, Diana. These are Puritans, and you're telling me they like sex?
Absolutely. They didn't want you to have it with anybody who left their wife, and they didn't want you to have it before you were married, and they were all very serious about that. And if you set up a society in which it is very easy to earn a living and there's lots of land that you can have and you absolutely cannot have sex before you get married, you will find that 19-year-old boys get married.
Yeah.
It works absolutely. And so in New England, where there was real prosperity and real moral rectitude, if you will, people were actually quite serious about that. I'm not saying, that nobody ever slipped up on the side, but in general, everybody was respectable. Everybody had a farm. You could marry the girl next door, and you could have a farm, and you could make a good living. You could support three or four small children. They did not have birth control. By the time the oldest child is 7 or 8, you can help around the farm. You can expand. You can be prosperous, and because in New England people were well-fed, they were living in warm houses, they had lots of fresh, pure water to drink, and they simply don't have the death rates that you have in the crowded cities. And so lots of New England families raise 10, 12 children, and the population doubles in less than 20 years. The population doubles. So you sort of start doing the math. There's 30,000 people who come over in the first wave of immigrants, and you double that every 18 or 19 years for a century, and you begin to run out of land. So the question of when New England started to go elsewhere has to do with the fact that New England settled the whole northern part of the country. It simply moved into, first into New Hampshire and western Massachusetts, and then upstate New York, and then out to Ohio, and right west, and they take the holiday with them. And they also had another kind of magic trick. In addition to being healthier because of those independent family farms and not having the kind of indentured servant conditions, let alone the kind of large-scale slave labor conditions that makes the economy and the population picture in the South very different, New England was the first place in the world that had public schools that were publicly supported and available to every child. which is to say it is the first large-scale state-level society that has universal literacy. New England children simply grew up knowing how to read and write and a great deal more than that. And that meant that if you really didn't like farming, you could find a job in the less literate parts of the United States. So that New Englanders moved into jobs as newspaper editors, as merchants, as peddlers sometimes. They'd be peddlers for a while from a wagon until they found a town that didn't have a store somewhere out in the frontier. And throughout the Upper South and even the Deep South, you find that because in some parts of the country, from the Appalachians going west and in the Deep South, you have very wealthy people. And then you have a lower class, which is not terribly literate. And so the preachers, the school teachers, the newspaper editors, the merchants, and even the guy who invented the cotton gin, because a Southern gentleman wouldn't have gotten his hands dirty in the smithy or in the workshop to do something like invent a cotton gin. I mean, all of those people come from New England to the Upper South and to the Lower South. And the idea of Thanksgiving is something they bring with them. Not terribly successfully in the South, but they do persuade a good deal of the Upper South and the Western states to adopt this idea. Some of it organically, just, if you're in a town out west somewhere and there's a lot of New Englanders around, you probably just join the holiday. But some of it as a deliberate campaign to unite these very different regions and states into a single country. There's a woman involved.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a very timely, and I hope you'll agree, it's an absolutely fascinating discussion with author Diana Muir Applebaum. And she's telling me about the origins and the subsequent spread of Thanksgiving from New England to the rest of the country. After the break, we will hear about the woman that she was just about to tell me about. Stay tuned.
Grateful for each hand we hold, gathered round this table. From far and near we travel home, blessed that we are able. Grateful for this sheltered place.
And now let's finish our discussion with Diana Muir Applebaum, historian, author, and the author specifically of a book called Thanksgiving, An American Holiday, and American History. Before the break, Diana was just about to tell me that, as with so many other important events in American history, there was a woman involved.
A New England girl named Sarah Josepha Hale, who was well-educated, and married to a young attorney, and he died, leaving her with several young children and no income. And so what she did was get herself, first she wrote a novel, and then she got herself a job, because the novel and some of her little articles she was writing attracted some attention, and she was invited to come to Philadelphia and edit a magazine. And she...
What year was this, Diana, or roughly what time was this?
This was in about 1830.
So in the early 19th century, now around 1830, this holiday has spread throughout the nation, except with a little bit of resistance in the South, and this woman now in Philadelphia. And what was her name again?
Her name was Sarah Josepha Hale.
Okay.
And it had spread. But, in the upper Midwest, you also have a tremendous number of Germans who have never heard of it. And you have people like Abraham Lincoln's parents who are moving into Illinois but wouldn't have heard of it, of Thanksgiving. And she also was very worried because although abolition hadn't really started as an important movement, people in New England were already worrying about that problem. And she felt that she was someone who would not have been an abolitionist. She felt rather that slavery was less important than the Union. And the main thing was to keep Americans together. Because remember, the War of 1812 wasn't that long ago. And she, like a lot of Americans, felt that the real threats might come from France and from England and from a dysfunctional national government. And so she wanted people to have the feeling that they were part of a single country. And so she wrote novels about, in her novels, a girl from Carolina would marry a boy from Massachusetts, and they would realize how much they had in common, and the families would become friends. That kind of thing. And part of her campaign to bring us together and make us a single country and get us all to think about how much we had in common, instead of thinking about whether or not we supported slavery, was the idea to celebrate Thanksgiving. And so she simply beat a drum constantly every year. Every year there was one of those kinds of stories in her magazine, or several of them all fall, where Thanksgiving would somehow unite a family, bring it together. A prodigal son would come home on Thanksgiving, uniting the family, that sort of thing. And she would print recipes, and she would write editorials, and she would write letters to governors. She'd write to the governor of Illinois or Indiana or Michigan saying, why haven't you proclaimed Thanksgiving yet this year? Or why didn't you do it last year? You've got to do it next year. And she was joined by a tremendous number of editors of small town and city newspapers. Out west and in the south, and ministers and associations of Christians, you know, the Presbyterian Church would join her in this and say that we should all get together and have a Thanksgiving Day because you know, we should all be worshiping God, we should all be unified as a country, it was good for families, it was unifying, it was everything positive. But it wasn't something that just happened. It was something that was pushed. It was a kind of, political marketing campaign, something like that.
Diana, this is absolutely astonishing to me because, of course, like most people, I've always thought of Thanksgiving as the quintessentially American holiday. And I guess it's always made me feel very American. And there's a lot, you know, it goes all the way back to the Pilgrims, all of that. I realized there was a religious aspect to it. I did not realize that there was essentially a public relations campaign designed to promote those ideas back in the early 19th century.
Yes. And the public relations campaign was coming unmistakably from one particular region of the country, and it was associated with certain churches and not with others. You have, for example, a serious debate in the Catholic Church about whether or not this is allowed. It's not on the Catholic calendar. It's not something a Catholic would have heard about before coming to this country. And so there was a brief debate, which was won by the idea that, you know, this was all right. It wasn't un-Catholic. It was permitted. But we've had repeats of those debates in later years. Jews had to think through whether this was actually acceptable, and the answer was yes. And now you have some pushback in the Muslim community, with some Muslims enthusiastically celebrating Thanksgiving and some imams saying, well, really, it's not a Muslim tradition. I suspect that'll get settled the same way the Catholic and Jewish debates got settled. But it's a very American thing. But if we go back to the 1630s, there begins to be a little bit of resistance in the South as the abolition movement comes on. Because the same people who are pushing abolition are pushing universal public education and mostly abolition, but also right.
These are the Congregationalist churches now, right?
Yeah, and not just the churches, but essentially it is churches, but churches split over this, so that's why you have one Baptist church for the north and one for the south. And several of the large Protestant churches actually split because at the time of the Civil War, and some of them split before. And politically, the nation is very divided, and it has to do with whether this comes into play with the question of whether the new territories out west, as they become states or as they are settled or as land is given out, are they going to be free or are they going to be slaves? And the North is very much into free labor. That's probably a bigger deal than abolition per se. Lots of people in the North don't have land, or they have sons who don't have land, and it is extremely important to them that this country be a place where a young man can have his own farm. The great fear by the 1840s and 50s is not of the Catholic Church anymore. Nobody really thinks by then that we're about to be conquered by France or Spain and forced to convert religiously. But they are very worried that labor will become something like it is in Europe. Instead of being, at that time in Europe, instead of being a country where free men have a farm and a vote, it would become a place where people work in terrible conditions for a wealthy landlord.
You know, before we go on from there, Diana, that's so important, and it's something that's often overlooked. I mean, obviously, the greatest victims of slavery were the slaves themselves. Obviously, there's no question about that. But a lot of other people were victimized, and poor white people who maybe were landless, who had nothing to sell but their labor, they were hurt by it too, because labor became, you're literally paying people slave wages. I mean, how can a free wage earner or a farmer work and compete with slaves?
That was the great question of the hour. It's not as though people didn't have a degree of sympathy for slaves, but frankly, this was a tremendously deeply racist country at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really had gotten past race at all. Maybe as humans, we're all more than a little bit selfish. From the perspective of the overwhelming majority of the population of the North, because the overwhelming majority of the population are working people. And they felt slavery was a tremendous threat to themselves, to their economic security, to their political security, to their children's future. They feared that they would not be able to compete with slaves, that if slaves were working in factories, if slaves were working on farms, or particularly that free land out west was so dominant, both in the reality of American economics and in the imagination of Americans, the idea of having your own farm and that your children could have their own farm. Even though we were becoming an industrial nation at that point, it still seemed to just about everyone in the North that the key was to have this as a free country. And I know that that's not exactly directly about Thanksgiving, except that at the time it was, because it was the same, it was a group of ideas that all went together, free public schools, universal manhood suffrage, in other words, that you got a vote even if you didn't have any property. That was still a hot issue at the time. So the idea that a poor man could vote, could hope to own a farm, could send his children to the public school, and could live in a country where he didn't have to compete with slave labor.
It's really odd, but what you're describing is two really fundamentally different systems, and one is much more egalitarian, and one in the South is almost feudal.
And, you know, that's exactly right. The South was founded on a much older idea, a hierarchical idea, an idea that some people have a birthright to prosperity, to freedom, and other people don't. Other people are born into a category where they should not expect to have any voice in the political conversation, should not even expect to have any voice in their own personal future. They should just not expect to own property. They should even expect to be property, that was somehow a right and natural thing, that one man should own another. That is the set of ideas. The truth about Virginia, I was born in Virginia, and the truth about Virginia is that it didn't get off its feet. That starving time at the beginning didn't end until they discovered tobacco and slavery.
Well, I didn't realize when I invited you on the show that you up there in Massachusetts are going to start beating up on the Commonwealth of Virginia the way you have been. But I guess facts are facts, and we have to deal with them. So I'm guessing then that a great deal of the resistance to this holiday in the South was just that they considered the holiday to be just a Yankee abolitionist idea, and it went hand in hand with all of this Yankee abolitionist talk, and they wanted no part of it.
Absolutely. It was just exactly as you say.
And there were newspaper editorials and people who spoke against. In fact, I seem to recall that there was one particular governor who responded rather strongly to Ms. Hale's letter asking him to celebrate the holiday.
Was that if you have that at your fingertips.
Yeah, it's been a while since you've read the book. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I seem to recall that there was one, was it South Carolina? It was a southern state, and he simply responded that he wanted none of it.
And absolutely.
And so this was a fairly common response in the South. Well, obviously, people in the South celebrate the holiday today. What changed their minds? Was it really, did they have to wait till after the Civil War before they began to adopt the holiday?
Yes, and a little longer. The Civil War, I see it, many other historians see it, as a contest between these two ideas. And the set of ideas that came out of New England won, and the set of ideas that came out of Virginia lost. But after the Civil War, many Southerners, you know, it took a generation or two generations. And then, you know, in the course of that time, you really would have to say that at a certain point, all Southerners have now come to believe in ideas like human equality and the fact that even poor people are entitled to vote, and to be horrified by the notion. Sometimes if you talk to a very a young child, an elementary school child, when they first encounter the idea of slavery, it just boggles their mind. And that's, you know, it's been a long time since that was untrue of any part of America. Americans are now, you know, horrified by that idea. They may be proud of their own ancestors. Certainly they can see that at the same time that all these things that I'm saying about Virginia are true, Virginia is the place that Thomas Jefferson came from. He's the one who put these ideas in a way that felt compelling, not only to everyone reading them in 1776, but to pretty much everyone in the world since. The idea of separating church and state in an efficient and kind of modern way comes out of Virginia. You know, Virginia is where the Bill of Rights comes from. Virginia gives us all of those ideas.
Yeah. Virginia did lots of good stuff.
All kinds of good stuff.
Okay. As long as we've got that straight. Okay, but maybe they got Thanksgiving wrong. But thank heaven, in Virginia, we do celebrate it now. And so the adoption was relatively late. It was in the late 19th century. When would you say that the holiday was pretty much universally accepted throughout the country?
Sometime around the turn of the century. There was a moment in there in the 1890s when a number of things happened, which you know, you can call them the colonial revival, or you can call them a reaction against the mass immigration that was coming from Europe. But Americans again kind of rediscover a common root, the kind of thing that that old-fashioned Yankee editor I was talking about before, Sarah Jessica Hale, where she would write about, you know, how much in common that girl from Carolina had with that boy from Massachusetts. And Americans begin to feel that way again. They are very interested in their colonial past. The Pilgrims become a kind of a major icon that they hadn't been. Jamestown also becomes a kind of an icon. Lots of illustrators in the magazines are drawing pictures of John Smith and Pocahontas and so on. And a kind of a rosy tinged, you know, glowing, vague picture of the colonial period and how charming it all was gets established. And Thanksgiving is part of that. It's also part of the prosperity of that era. People are rich. Lots of Americans are rich. And they want to have a lovely holiday. They can have parties. They can afford it. And Thanksgiving becomes a kind of symbol of American prosperity and American-ness and American culture and the colonial past. And it becomes really very popular in the 1890s, North and South. Maybe it's even part of the way of getting over the Civil War, which a number of things were. Again, looking for things that can unite everyone. That was important. It was important, and it happened in negative ways, too. North and South, pretty much all the upscale people agreed that black people could be pretty much ignored and stepped on, and that would be all right, because as long as all the white people are getting on. or at least all the white upscale people are getting on. And that's a little uncomfortable, but that was part of the post-war reconciliation that we had. And it takes a while to, again, get to the point in American history where we can even think in a serious way about the civil rights of non-white citizens. All of that is now also way in the past. But in 1890 to 1920 or so, there's a kind of a sweep all that under the rug, all the things we fought a civil war over.
A period of time often called the low point of race relations in the country. Well, I'm happy to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Thanksgiving is celebrated now in households both rich and modest and black and white and of most persuasions, if not all persuasions in the country. Maybe the recent immigrants have yet to adopt it, but it's pretty much universal now, isn't it?
It is and has been for a long time. Black Americans never bought into the idea that they weren't part of the American conversation.
So they were busy celebrating
this holiday. Were celebrating,
well, good for them.
Thanksgiving, and they were, they were Republicans, and they were, they felt themselves to be very American. They were just having a hard time persuading powerful white Americans that that was true.
Understood.
That's kind of the reality. And of course, there is a little, there's a little dissent. In terms of Thanksgiving, holidays can be so useful to someone who has a political cause. And so there is a lot of self-criticism from the American Indian movement that somehow Thanksgiving is associated with white conquest, British conquest. So, I don't know. We're always arguing over something that's part of what American is, isn't it? That we have the right to do that.
Well, you're correct, Diana. There are always ongoing debates, and I want you to settle one now between my wife and me.
Okay.
Of course, we all know cornbread stuffing is the best stuffing. There's no debate there. But do you add oysters to your cornbread stuffing or not?
I do not.
Thank you. My wife does. Now, I must admit that oysters in stuffing are very good, but cornbread stuffing, purely spoken, has nothing in it but cornbread and a few other ingredients that my mom uses.
Well, we do have an agreed-upon National Thanksgiving menu. There's turkey and there's cranberries and pumpkin and potatoes. And when you get beyond that, though, it gets a little dicey. Families have there are regional varieties. I mean, this is a whole fascinating topic.
Well, this is America, and I'm very happy that people have their regional variants, but the standard is my mom.
Okay,
as long as we've got that straight. Well, Diane Applebaum, I think we're way out of time, but thank you so very much for shedding some absolutely fascinating light on the status of our national holiday as being wrapped up very deeply in our ongoing constitutional debate and touching upon all these issues of status and class and economic organization and slavery and civil rights. And I just really had no idea. And you've written a fascinating book and a fascinating tale. And thank you very much for sharing it with us.
My pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Diana Muir Applebaum, who wrote that remarkable book all those years ago and which I just recently found out about. Again, the title of the book is Thanksgiving, An American Holiday and American History. I'm sure you can find it online. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.